Hey guys, before we start, a quick shout out to Alpha Dog Nutrition for sponsoring this podcast. Alpha Dog products are now available at dusupply.com, and you can use code ALPHADOG15 at checkout for 15% off and a credit for free shipping to try it yourself. Now let's get you to your podcast.
Where's Fielder?
He's gone to the dogs.
Welcome, friends, to the Gone to the Dogs podcast. Steve Fielder here with you this week. Our good friend Corey Groover is on maternity watch. He's expecting a new baby at home. He and his wife Kayla, and we certainly wish them the best with that. And he's going to be off here probably a few weeks until the house gets back in order there and Kayla lets him out, I guess. And but we certainly do miss Corey and hope that he's everything's going well there. I've got a good friend on the podcast today, a guy that I've known for a long time. We tried to figure out one day how long we've been knowing each other, and I'm not sure we figured it out, did we, Mac? How long has it been?
I want to say I first met you. You were still at UKC. It was at the Winter Classic, and I believe it was 94. Does that sound right?
Well, I was still with UKC in 94. That's right. I think it was 98. That I went to PKC. So that could be absolutely right.
Yeah, 94, yeah. 95, one somewhere right in there. So. Okay.
All right. Well, folks, we're talking with Mac Britt. I call him, I don't call him this to his face because he's bigger and younger and stronger than I am, but he's one of those old Florida swamp rats. He's all he's known for his, 50 years? How old are you, Mac?
52. I'll be 53 in September.
All right. Well, for all of those 53 years, he's lived in the great state of Florida. And when I first met him, we talked some about the hunting and all. And of course, I had become acquainted with Florida hunting in the 60s when I was in college in Lakeland, which is not very far from where Mac is. Where are you, Mac, down there? Where do you call home?
It's Parrish, Florida.
Parrish.
So I was born in Brooksville, but most of my life I've been raised in Parrish, Florida.
Okay, Parrish is, we went through that little town when we go down and hunt around those big orange groves down there around Arcadia.
Yes, sir.
And Parrish is one of those towns that's got the welcome and come back again sign on the same post.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, it used to. Now it's got all kind of subdivisions built around it.
Oh, it's growing just like everything else down
here.
Oh,
my goodness. Not to my liking.
Absolutely. They're ruining our Florida. When I came to Florida in 1966, I loved it down here. It was hot, I'll admit. It was hot, and I wasn't quite used to the heat. But I loved the big open pasture fields and the cattle. Man, Florida's got more cows than Texas, if you can believe that. Or they used to. I think they still do. And the orange groves everywhere. And then I haven't been acquainted with the plot dogs. There was a fellow named John Miller who lived in Tampa, and John was from up around Steubenville, Ohio originally, or Weirton, West Virginia, that area, and he had moved down here and worked for Tampa Electric, I believe, and John was a great guy and a tough coon hunter, and he introduced me to Florida coon hunting. And that included some nights we'd go in. John said, "Steve, wait back here. I'll go into the tree first." Sometimes he'd come back and he'd have that corn knife or that machete, and he'd have one of those old nose shoulders hanging off of it. the tip of its tail hitting the ground on one side and the head on the other. And sometimes they had those rattles on the end. So. Man, I remember. Well, that's one of the things we want to talk about tonight or today is Florida hunting. It's a different breed of cat for sure of anything else that I've tried around the country. And I have hunted out west. I've hunted along the Bighorn River in Wyoming for coons, if you can imagine that. And Florida is unique, and the Florida hunter is unique in my opinion. And so I just wanted to bring Mac on. He and I hunt together. He takes mercy on me and takes me to the woods, and he hacks his way through those palmetto thickets and some of those woolly heads, I call them, that we have to go in sometimes to the dogs. And he takes good care of me, and I appreciate that. And of course, Mac handled a dog for me back. Some people will remember when I was running the Cruz dog, the Walker dog, and Mac handled Cruz for me and did a good job. He did a better job than Cruz did. But anyway, we had some good times. Mac, let's talk a little bit about, okay, we're on the West Coast, both of us. I'm a little north of you.
Yes.
What, about an hour and a half, maybe?
Yes, sir. Yeah, you're about an hour, because I'm about 45 minutes south of Tampa, and I think you're about, what, 40, 45 minutes north?
Well, yeah, that'd be stretching it. Probably, yeah, 30, 35, maybe.
Somewhere in that range, so.
Yeah.
But so, you're north of Tampa, I'm south of Tampa.
Yeah, and what people think, they ask me about, you know, where I live. Well, when I travel and I cross the Florida line coming home, I still have 3.5 hours to get home. Most of my travels, I'm either running up I-75 or up Interstate 95. And either way, there I'm over fairly close to Jacksonville. I've got my shortcuts that I've learned, since I've been here. But still, I can look at it at 3.5 hours home from the Florida line. So we're fair ways down, I guess, probably about halfway down the state. Maybe not quite, but you're further down than I am. And to me, that translates to a little higher temperatures in the summertime and all. But let's, while we're on the subject of Florida, just kind of set the stage here for what we're talking about. Let's talk a little bit about what the hunting's like down here, Mac. And then I want to get with you on, you know, your experiences and how long you've been hunting and all of those things. But what does the country typically consist of that you hunt there around where you are?
Mostly where I'm at, I've got one little farm that they generally just hunt tomato fields, but it's mostly just flat. When it's dry, it's real sandy. And when it's wet, it's real mucky and the creeks come out of the banks and everything. It's the oak trees and the thickets. It's kind of hard to explain. I mean, the oaks are good size, but they're not gigantic like you see up north or whatever, but they're still good size. But like right now, when I try to explain people, like trying to see a dog sniffing this sand, it's like when you pick up a bag of sugar and you try to run your hand through it and it just granularly comes through. That's kind of what you run into in the dry season. And then, like I said, when it gets rainy season, it could get muddy as all dickens, and sometimes even a four-wheel drive don't help you some, but it's mostly just flat country. There's no hills, no nothing in this area, just flat farmland and swamps. And if you're fortunate, like some of the guys I hunt with, they got a couple groves left. And like I said, when it's dry, it gets real sugar sandy out there and everything until it gets some rain on it and all. But it's all flat land too.
Well, yeah, it is flat down here, and that's in my favor at my age. I don't do those hills anymore.
Yeah,
it's not that I wouldn't like to. I love to hunt the mountains and those mountain ridges and all of that, and that's what I dream about, but I can't physically do that anymore. So basically, I've noticed that when I'm down here, a lot of times you're hunting along creeks that have pretty steep little banks, slippery banks, where the water or the creek is eroded into the pasture field or around the as you mentioned, these vegetable fields. There's a lot of stuff grown to eat in the state of Florida. I know you and I've been out there around some of the places, and I've taken home a tomato or two after the hunt. And I know one time I got my pockets full of yellow squash. I won't tell your landowner about all that. Okay. I don't think he'll probably be listening. But anyway, we grow a lot of stuff down here, and because of the long seasons, I guess they can go, you know, maybe have a couple crops. They
used to do what they called a spring and a fall, where they plant both times of the year. But here lately, it's either been in the fall or either in the spring.
They do one or the other.
Now, unfortunately, there's getting fewer and fewer farms. They've kind of cut back on their production and everything. Mm. So,
all right. Well, one of the things I mentioned earlier there was hunting in the orange groves. And I did that way back in the 60s. And that's kind of a unique style of hunting. I mean, these orange groves are some of them can be pretty big, can't they?
Yes, some of them you get, and some of them, you know, that's surviving the greening right now, which that's another subject. But it, you know, like you said, they can grow together. And I've heard guys say, oh, you hunt them groves, they're easy to find. Well, they can hide up there better than what you think they can, because I've a few times just thought the dogs just absolutely missed, and then either I'd see it again or somebody with me would say, well, here it is right here, and it'd get up there and hide in the tree, and you wouldn't even realize it. So they can't hide in there.
Yeah, well, the trees are planted in rows, of course, and they're a bushy-like tree. They don't grow real tall.
Yes.
And usually, in my experience, the coons goes to the top, usually, don't they?
Most of the time, yes. So.
Yeah.
And if they plant them close enough, they just, after years, they eventually just grow into one, and it just looks like a big, big long hedge in some of them.
Hedgerow, right. And they can cross out, of course, from one to the other.
Yes.
For sure. But it's a little different. Those coon do like those oranges, and the oranges grow in the wintertime down here. What typically is orange season down here?
I think it's generally from November till about March or April, because you get your early, what they call the earlies in the fall. And then the Valencias and all that come like in January, February. And
those are more your juice oranges and so forth,
sir.
Right?
Yes, sir. And generally about January, when we can get a decent frost down here, that's when they really start to sweeten up.
Yeah, man. And those coon like them for sure.
Yes, they do.
And we've had some good races in those orange groves, you know.
Yes.
But invariably, if that coon's going to run, it seems that he'll end up in one of those bad heads, as we call
them. If he can get a good enough head start, he's going to try.
Yeah, yeah. And these are places that typically are just low sinkholes or creeks or so forth. Correct me if I'm wrong here, Mac. They couldn't plant trees. It wasn't something they could.
Most of your orange trees are generally on high ground because they can't really take a lot of water, or at least the natural water. So they try to plant them on as much high ground as they possibly can. So
right.
They will be in low areas, but generally typically they're on high ground if possible.
All right. Well, we're giving people kind of a lesson in horticulture here on this Coon Hunting Podcast. But, you know, I had a brother-in-law who has passed on that worked for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And he worked in Florida, you know, since he was a very young man. He was actually born in Georgia. But he, you know, told me a lot about the citrus industry. And it was interesting for me to learn that they use the root of a lemon tree. And then they graft to that root because I guess it's a hardier root. Do you know anything about that, Mac?
I'm not too familiar with how they plant them. So, because I know most of the root system on it, from what I've seen when they get blown over from the hurricanes or whatever, generally the roots are pretty much ground level. They don't really dig into the ground very well.
Right. They just spread out.
They just spread out. Like I said, when the, unfortunately, these last couple of hurricanes, some of the trees that were lost, when they get pushed over, you can just see the root system and it's just spread out, not really deep or anything.
Well, we talked, Corey and I talked, I think it was last week, and he was kind of laughing about my trip to New Jersey when I got into an earthquake, a total eclipse of the sun, of this kind of stuff, you know. But Florida presents, well, I guess the people that live along the coast of the Gulf of Mexico and in New Orleans and Mississippi and Alabama and all Georgia, they understand about hurricanes like we do. But hurricanes are bad boys.
Yes.
When they come in, they kind of rearrange.
They don't show no mercy.
That's right. Well, I've survived two or three now since I've been down here, and none of them have, thankfully, have really done any damage here. Just put a lot of limbs down in the yard, a lot of trash.
Yeah, the last
tree.
Couple, we've definitely been fortunate.
Yeah,
but
that's for
unfortunately
sure.
our fortune is somebody else's misfortune.
Yep, that's right. Well, okay, you were born in Brooksville, you say. Brooksville's just north and east a little bit of where I am. I can be up at Brooksville in about 30 minutes, I guess, 35, something like that. Well, if you get into Brooksville, I guess, does the Withlacoochee River come in there at Brooksville?
Yes, sir. I believe, was it on the east side over there by where Chrome and all is? I believe that's the Withlacoochee,
yeah.
I think.
Mm-hmm. When I was in college in Florida, my buddies and I used to come up squirrel hunting in the Rich Sloan Wildlife Management area there along the Withlacoochee River. And beautiful woods, you know, and Spanish moss-draped oak trees. You talked about oaks earlier, and, you know, it's a different kind of oak down here. It's not a white oak or a red oak like we'd find out, or pin oak, post oaks. It's a live oak. and I've talked myself hoarse already today, it seems. But those things have a lot of acorns and a lot of game eat them, don't they?
Yes. Yeah. When the acorns come in, you know, between the coons and the hogs, they generally work on them. And I'm sure the squirrels eat on them too. So.
Yeah, we have, I don't have any live oaks on my property here. I do have a couple of camphor trees and those things, they are constantly year round putting off something, some kind of bud or some kind of sounds like you got a little exterior noise there somewhere, man.
Yeah, a guy from Tico.
Somebody going to
back. Tico guy's got his back rear reverse.
A wide load beeper. Huh?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Get out of my way.
That's like the kid that was in the store or in the bank line with his dad, and it was a rather hefty woman in line in front of her, you know. And that was back in the days when people used beepers, you know, for their phone. Mm. Lady's beeper went out went off and the kid said, "Watch out, Dad, she's backing up." Oh, I'm going to get hate mail for that one. But all right, so we kind of talked a little bit about Florida. We know it's hot. But if you're a Florida coon hunter, you pretty much hunt year-round anyway, don't you?
Yes, sir. If you can stand the heat in the summer, there's no season in Florida, so it's 365, 7 days a week if you're able to.
Yeah, if you can stand it. I kind of liken it to opening the door on an oven and sticking your head in there to check on the pizza.
Yes.
That's kind of what it feels like when I walk out my door in July or August or September.
July and August are about the two worst months to try to hunt down here. So
yeah.
It's not fun. When the nighttime is 82 or 83 degrees and muggy and mosquitoes buzzing on your ear, you wonder how much fun is this really going to be?
Man, I remember that night you were hunting cruise for me and we drew out went up around the Ocala area up there. And I believe Malcolm Raines was our guide that night.
Yes.
And we went out on one of Ike Rainey's properties there and you guys got the dogs out and all. I was going to stay in the truck and watch on the Garmin. I think I lasted out there about 3 seconds. Those mosquitoes trying to carry me off.
Well, it didn't help either that we was parked right beside a flag pond, too. That didn't help matters.
Okay. When you say a flag pond, tell me what you mean by that.
It's just basically like a little low area, a wet weather pond. It's just like a pasture, like very low pasture land in the summer when you get a lot of rain and water just kind of stands out there and everything.
So. Oh, yeah. And the frogs and mosquitoes.
Yes.
I bet you that I killed 50 mosquitoes inside that truck once I got inside and got the doors closed.
Yeah. And that's not counting the ones you missed.
Oh, man. That's one of the things I remember when I first came down and was in college and went to use payphone down there on campus and went in a phone booth and the light was on there. You know, it's nighttime. Mm-hmm. There must have been a bazillion mosquitoes in that booth.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the
they
bad part.
They had me pick clean like a bunch of piranhas before I got it.
Well, I mean, I guess it helps now with these lights because you got those amber lights and all, but, you know, you're wearing the headlamps and then, you know, how those bugs get around those headlamps and everything. So it makes it interesting.
For sure. Now, you're feeding what, 3 walker dogs right now?
2.
Or 4? Oh, just 2 now.
Yes, okay. Sir, I just got 2 right now, so male and a female. Got you.
All right. You still have Minnie?
Yes, sir. Still got her. She'll be 9 at the end of May. And I got that young dog, Clutch. He's a 2-year-old. He's off of Bad Butch. I got him from Wayne Hunter last August. So, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, no. It's on me. You haven't downsized quite as much as I have. Down here in Florida, I'm down to a 20-pound long-haired dachshund.
Yeah, but you own 50% of a good plot dog up in North Carolina, though.
Yeah, old Fever. I've got a good buddy up there that kind of keeps me in the game. But thanks to technology, I get to see the videos and share the pictures and all. But all right, so you got 2 walker dogs. Let's wind the tape back to your first memories of coon hunting in Florida. What do you remember?
I was 7 or 8 years old, and I went with my dad and a guy he used to hunt with, Bill Landers. And we went out to some property that we had years ago. And from what I remember, we didn't really do a whole lot that night, but it was just something about being out there with the dogs and everything. And it just something clicked. And from that point forward, it just was like, I guess you said it was a fever. It was a fever I didn't ever want to get rid of. So, and just the older I got, the more I got into it and everything. And it just, when people ask me about it, I said, it's something that I can't explain. I said, it's just, I guess like the deer hunters or whatever, there's just a love for it. And I just hope that love never goes away.
Yeah. Well, I have to give you credit because you are a coon hunter. I mean, you are out there on nights that it's too hot for me. I mean, you know, I could make it, but I wouldn't enjoy it. But yet, you know, if you've got a dog there that needs to be hunted, you hunt it. And I understand that you love it. And to me, you exemplify the Florida hunter, tough.
And, well, I don't know about all that.
Resilient and determined. I'll say that. Well, you know, when you hunt, as I did for 20-some years in Michigan, and I hunt around cornfields and soybean fields and woodlots that were nice and open with big timber in them, and very few, no poisonous snakes. I remember one time seeing one of my farmers that I hunted on was skinning out. They have a little rattler up there. It's kind of a pygmy rattler. They call it a Massasauga rattlesnake. It's short. And they are poisonous. But I never saw a poisonous snake the whole time, 20-some years that I lived in Michigan. And very rarely saw any type of snake at all. So down here, you know, when I learned to kind of watch where I put my feet, I won't say that I'm terrified of snakes. They don't keep me out of the woods. And you rarely see them, do you? I mean, you don't see snakes a lot.
You don't see them a lot. I mean, you're aware that they're around there and everything, but you just, like you said, you just kind of keep an eye on it. So, I mean, there's some nights you might see a couple, then you might go away a time and not hardly see any. So, I mean, it's just like the gators. You might see one or two sitting out there. Then you might go another dozen trips and not see anything, but you know they're there.
Yeah. Well, I remember that night up at Rich Loam, we walked into a tree and got almost into the tree. And you said something. Did you see your buddy back there as we come by or something?
Yeah, he was kind of easing back. I think it was when I think Cruz was still down here and we made a tree and you were kind of easing back wanting to see it. And I shot my light and I seen them red eyes behind you a little ways. I'm like, your buddy's back there looking at you. And you're like, huh? And I went, watch where you step. There's one sitting back there. And you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah. And that was not a snake. That was a gator or a gator.
Yes.
Chomp, chomp. Yeah. Well, you know, I've been hunting down here around lakes and all at times with our friend Bill Slaughter and some with my buddy, our friend Gordy Schrader. And, you know, see the lakes, you know, pretty full of them. Mm-hmm. And that cruise dog, I remember him hunting one night with Bill and Pam and, you know, he ran a track. And he got around this little lake. I don't know, maybe that's what you call flag pond. I'm not sure. But anyway, there were gators in that thing. And I'm thinking, you shouldn't be out there, buddy. You need to be somewhere else. But
our other nickname for them is Big Green Lizard.
Big Green Lizard. Yeah, they are that for sure. So you started hunting then when you were just a kid with your dad. Was he a lifelong coon hunter?
No, sir. He did it some. He didn't care nothing for the hunts. He just pleasure hunted. And he just wanted to be out there just for fun or whatever. But I probably got up in my teenage years, and for whatever the reason, he just kind of lost interest in it. But there were some other gentlemen in the area that still hunted, so I got acquainted with them and was able to start hunting with them. And up until, you know, I got old enough and everything, and I went to my first competition. I was probably 18, but he'd always get the hunting magazines, the Full Cry, American mm-hmm. Cooner. And I would just, you know, just flip through them. He would go with me just to go because he didn't care. Like I said, he didn't care nothing for the hunts, but he didn't mind going watching the bench show, the tree and contest and just sitting around and talking dog talk and everything. So, and then when I was old enough to do it on my own, I started to do it, but he said he didn't care for it because he went out there to enjoy himself and he didn't want to argue over whose dog struck first or whose dog treed first because it didn't matter to him.
You mean coon hunters in Florida argue?
Well, wow. They have disagreements. I'll put it that way.
Yeah. Well, you know, you used to have quite a few clubs down here back in the day.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. There was the Alify Club, which was over in Lithia, Florida. The Central Club, which is still going right now. It used to really be going. What is it? You got the one in Scottsmore now.
Yeah, Earl Bellamore, isn't it?
Yes.
That pretty much oversees that club over there. For years ago, there was a fellow named Doc Heminger that was up at the Citra Club, I believe. That was kind of a club he kind of oversees. I haven't thought of our old buddy Red in a while. Is Red still involved in the club up there?
I'm assuming he is. I haven't heard anything from anybody, but I haven't been up there in probably a year and a half. So, but I would assume he's still around. I think the one time I talked to Gordy, I think Gordy said he was still coming around a little bit. So
it's kind of interesting that you tend to associate when you mention a given club, there's usually one person that you think about that's kind of the honcho, that's kind of, you know, kept the ball rolling down through the years. But Florida is one of the states, I believe, that, you know, really suffered when club membership started to wane and the hunt started to get smaller and all. It seemed to me like that the clubs in Florida. Now, up in the West, in what we call West Florida, or that panhandle that runs just south of Alabama and Mississippi, over toward Mississippi, you know, there's probably more clubs up there, or there used to be.
Yeah, what is it? Crawfordville. Or the last couple of years. I don't know if that's the same as the St. Mark's. Isn't that the one that Johnny Brinkley used to do, or is that a different one?
You know, I don't know for sure. My friend Johnny Brinkley is in his 80s now, and he's pretty much quit coon hunting. He's had some breathing problems and all, but I used to always go up and hunt with Johnny in January, the week of the UKC Winter Classic. And Johnny, he has some rough hunting. Thick, oh my gosh. But he had a few places, you know. He called them, ponds. Ponds, cypress ponds. That's where we'd tree the coons. We'd have to go into the pond. And he, like you, would carry a cane knife or a machete. And somebody was there hunting with him and kidded him about all he heard that night was a chinky chink chink of that knife. Because when Johnny walked into the tree, he always blazed a trail in there with his cane knife, which is a knife they used to cut sugar cane. But I guess it's a machete just the same, wouldn't you say?
Yes, I've got both an old cane knife and a machete. So, yeah, and they've both been used quite regular.
Oh man, I think I posted on social media one night where you were hacking your way into the tree ahead of me through those. Now, palmettos are they look like a palm tree that grows off the ground to me. They got blades, long blades, like knives on them. And those things will cut you as you go through. They got like a razor edge, don't they?
Yes, I have had my hand, especially when you stumble over those roots because you can't see them the way everything is, and your instinct is to grab some. Now I understand why some of these guys were wearing gloves, because your instinct is to grab, and when you do, and as you fall, that's like a razor just, or a knife just basically slicing on your hand, so...
Oh, yeah.
They're sharp.
So let's look at this now. All right, we've got mosquitoes that are big enough to carry you off and eat you somewhere else. We've got temperatures that range from hot to super hot. You know, sometimes at night you're out there 12, 1 o'clock in the morning and it's still 85 degrees. And the humidity is so thick that you can just take a bite out of it. It feels like you're wearing a wool sweater in August. So we have that. And then we have thick woods with palmettos and what did Johnny call those things? Tie-dyes.
Yes. There's a few of those around here too. And some of the guys years ago, which they don't now, but before Pinellas County built up, they used to hunt out there on the bay in the mangroves. And that was some, if you ever been close to the coast and see all those bushes and all, and them guys used to hunt that years ago too, when they didn't have nowhere else to go. They could hunt out on those salt flats.
Yeah, exactly. And there's one place, a park, that I launch my kayak to fish out in the flats, which I do. Haven't been doing as much lately, and I got to get back out there. I'm getting lazy. But anyway, I see raccoons in the daytime when I'm kayaking around those mangrove thickets. And the redfish, like to go into those mangroves and feed there, you know, on the high tide. I guess they get those fiddler crabs or little hermit crabs and so forth that are on those mangroves. And I have seen several coons in the daytime on low tide are out there feeding. And then at this one particular place, there's an area where the fishermen, when they come in, they'll dump their bait there, bait, typically shrimp. And, man, those coons get into that, you know, and they love that. But anyway, yeah, so we've got all this thick vegetation. Then we've got snakes. We've got all the types of poisonous snakes down here. And probably the most aggravating is the cottonmouth moccasin. He's the most plentiful and probably the most aggressive, wouldn't you say?
Yes. I mean, generally, you're not going to run into your rattlesnakes unless you get into a real thick spot and just happen to walk up on them and startle them. But they're not out actually looking for you. But the water moccasin would probably be your most prevalent, I would say.
Yeah. And a lot of the timber that you go into is flooded, okay, because any low-lying place here will hold water. Of course, it seeps away due to the sandy soil. But, you know, most of these places where we treat coons, you tend to be in water, don't you?
Yes. Mostly, if you can try to find, if you can stay in the thick swamps or the creek bottoms, that's generally where you're going to find, especially in the summer coming up, because there's nothing really out there except the bugs or whatever, because there's no crops and the oranges and everything are gone. So if you can find water, that's generally where most of your coon are going to be hanging out.
Right. So we have poisonous reptiles. They even have scorpions down here. Now, I have not seen a scorpion since I've been here. Have you seen scorpions in your experience?
No, I've heard them, but I have not seen them. And so far, knock on wood, but I think they're more down towards the Everglades. I have not seen a python yet.
Right. I wondered if you were going to mention that. Some mental giant, I guess. I don't know who the guy was that brought the first one over there and turned him loose in the Everglades. But we have Burmese pythons that can be – how big can those suckers be? They can be over 20 feet long.
I say some of them pictures, they're showing them like 20, 25 feet long. So I'm like, I don't want to walk up on that at night.
Yeah. If you, you know, going down to Old Spot in their tree and you're all under the ether of that big loud tree bark and you're skipping along there and your toe catches in one of those roots or one of those cat claw briars or bamboo briars, they call them. Oh, there's so many lovely things down here. Oh. But anyway, and you go and hit the ground and big old boy decides, whoo, there's lunch. And he just wraps that big 20-foot long body around you and starts squeezing. You've had a bad day.
Yes. Well, let me tell you this quick story, and I hope you don't get mad at me for saying it, but talking about snakes. Me and James White was hunting a few years ago up there at Rich Loam, and it was January, February, but it was one of them years it was real wet in there. And we had got a split tree. His was on one, I was on the other. So I went to mine, he started to his. And we're sitting there, and we could holler. We'd see each other's light, and we could holler back and forth at each other. And the swamp was deep enough, you had to stand on your tiptoes to keep it from going in your boot. Well, anyway, I had mine, and he was hollering. He was going to grab his, and we was going to get out of there. And then all of a sudden, I hear him squall. I'm like, what is – I said, what? What happened? And what he had done, he was trying to crawl across a log to lift his leg up. He set his hand down. And about a couple feet from it, there was a water moccasin laying right there. So he let out a big old, you know what? And yeah, of course, it was so deep. The water was so deep, you couldn't just run over there. So, but hopefully if he's listening, he won't get mad at me telling that story. But
James is my hero. The last time I hunted with James, I was hunting that cruise dog, and we were hunting up there with the at the club that Gary Langford was running there, PKC hunt that night. And right at the end of the hunt, old Cruz got treed over to the right over in there. And before I could say no or thank him or whatever, he got my dog leash and headed to Cruz, man. And it wasn't long that he said, just follow this trail on back to the truck. And by the time I got to the truck, James had caught up with me with my dog. So that's the kind of guy that I appreciate, I tell you what. But anyway, yeah, there's a lot. That's something else we could talk about a little bit here. We're titling this podcast this week, Hunting the Florida Swamps. There's been a lot of good hunters down here over the years. Do you remember any of your mentors, people that you hunted with as a kid? And
this area that I hunted in, there was a few. I know some of your older ones might remember R.S. Montgomery. He hunted down here. His son, Hoss, he doesn't hunt anymore, but I hunted with him some. And then the guy that you used to know and all that came down from Ohio, Gene Riley, he had a winter home down here, and I would hunt with him some. And while he was, you know, back and forth. And then during the summer, when I got old enough, I'd make some trips to Ohio, and that's where I got introduced to all that good hunting up there. But, and then, like I said, I hunted years ago, like the groves we hunt, this guy, Ray Carter, he had permission for that years ago. And then I met Leroy Hancock and Dale, and there was always just a bunch of good group of guys, you know, that we hunted with and everything. So that's kind of the group that I mostly hunted with growing up and everything. And then unfortunately life moves on, and they do in life too. So, you know, I miss them. There's times I wish they were still around. We had some pretty good stories to tell. So.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that's all of our stories have chapters like that of the people that we hunted with years ago that we enjoyed hunting with so much, and that they're gone. You know, I could spend a whole podcast here just naming names, just of the fellows up in Michigan that I hunted with, you know, over the years that have passed on now. Yeah. People remember Ed Mead, the blue tick guy, you know, and Ed and I hunted together many times. We did a lot of training together. And without, you know, mentioning all, there was a, I called him the old Hungarian farmer, Eddie Leitz, who lived outside of Kalamazoo there. And I hunted many nights with Eddie and with his friend Bud Bauer and on and on and on, the fellows, you know, that we had so many good hunts, so many memorable hunts. And I've always been a picture taker. You know, I like to take pictures. And Nubbin Moore, he laughs about our friend Fred Sanders out from Mississippi when we would go to the White River. And we'd get the dogs out and all, and I'd want to shoot a few pictures and maybe turn the dogs loose or whatever. And old Fred, he'd go, huh? We could have treed 4 or 5 coons if it wasn't for this damn movie shoot. And he thought that was just a bunch of nonsense.
Oh, yeah.
And well, I think we got some around here that probably feel that way, too.
I was up there when we used to, when they used to have those old throwaway cameras that you could take to Walgreens or whatever and turn the whole thing in. And I'd take it out there and I'd try to snap a few pictures, you know, dogs on the tree, whatever. And I'd sneak up and I'd see the guy, how he'd sit around the hood of the truck telling a story or whatever. And I went by there and I was like, I tried to catch him. I was like, Dale, turn around. And he thought he was going to flash that light on me. And he got ready to flash the light on me before I, and I snapped him and blinded him before he hit the light.
Yeah, no more coons for him. Was that a competition hunt?
No, sir. We were just hanging around, just having a regular pleasure hunt and all. And it was, you know, like I said, it was good times. We'd razz each other and everything. And they even one time turned out, Dale's, I'd caught mine. That's when those wildlife trackers was just first coming out, and I ended up getting one, and I was still green. I didn't know how to use it very well, and I got up there, and I thought the dog was one way, and he came back to the truck the other way, and we were sitting there, and as I was going back, they had him in their truck, and Dale's dog got in this one bad swamp, and Dale's like, man, I did not want to go in there tonight. He said, because mine's the only one in there. And Ray reached over and said, well, here, hang on. I'll give you some company. He reached up and opened the door and let mine out. And mine got in there. He said, now you got some company to go in there with you. I was like, man, why'd you do that? I don't want to go. And it was one of them swamps when you step the mud, it goes straight to your knees or whatever. And so I was I thought, I'll remember this, guys. Don't worry. I'll get payback. So,
we used to hunt people on social media probably recognize the name Wayne Allen, and certainly anybody that ran the Purina race over the years will remember Wayne's participation. And I think he served as the plot rep for the Purina Award, and from up in Cartersville, Georgia, Wayne. You know, did very well with his plot dogs, his northern plot, North Georgia plot kennels, he called it. But we would go every year at plot days, regardless of where it was, we would have a standing date to go pleasure hunting on Wednesday night. Everything started off on Thursday night with the breed hunt and then the two nights registered, Friday and Saturday and so forth. But we'd get there early and go on a Wednesday night. And Mike Houston from Missouri and Wayne and I would hunt together. And occasionally there would be other fellows along. But Mike and Wayne, they would try, when we would get to the woods, it was a race to see which one could slip his dog loose first. While everybody else is standing around, getting their lights on, getting their boots and everything else. And then you'd hear a dog open back there in the woods somewhere. And Wayne said, dang on you, Houston. How'd that dog get loose? And that was just a joke with those guys. And they do it quite often, you know, when we get together. just having fun. You know, this coon hunting thing's supposed to be fun. I see a lot of people on Facebook and social media that aren't having fun with it. They're being critical. They're being envious. They're being, they're looking for drama. Well, man, there's been a lot of drama out on the hunts that I've been on. But I don't think it was intentional, and it was, and we had a heck of a lot of fun with it.
But, some of that it's.
Listen, Matt. We've been at it here about 50 minutes, and as we go down the wire here another 10 or 15 minutes, I wanted to ask you about how things have changed in Florida coon hunting over the years that you've been involved. You said, you know, you're in your early 50s and you started when you were just a kid. How have things changed overall down here?
Well, it started out years ago where the landowners just kind of started getting, well, they'd let, you know, different people, you know, turkey hunt, deer hunt, whatever. And then they started having people go out there falling down, you know, then got on the soup, you know, sue. So they didn't want nobody out there, you know, for that. And then I'd say the last 10 to 15 years, the developers started moving in. And then all the older landowners that used to be around, they've all passed on. And so now the kids have gotten it. And for whatever the reason, I guess these developers are just throwing the money at them, and they'd rather take the money than, you know, hold on to the land or anything. Maybe it's taxes or for whatever the reason, I don't know. But, and it's just gotten smaller and smaller where, just like now, most of the places that I used to hunt is all subdivisions now. And, you know, what used to be old dirt roads are all 2 to 4 lane highways with, you know, bypasses being built and everything. So it's just, I don't know where everybody's coming to Florida now. And I don't know where they're coming from, but it's just hard to, you know, the land is just disappearing faster than, you know, than what you can find. Yeah. And unfortunately, like for me to go anywhere decent now, I basically got to drive an hour and 15 minutes to, you know, go to a decent spot.
Well, I knew when I settled here where I did, there were a lot of factors involved, and I knew that I was not settling in a prime coon hunting location. I had been in Florida enough to know, having gone to college here and so forth and made many, many trips over the years to Florida, I knew that my coon hunting in Florida was going to be seasonal. I knew I wasn't going to be a hardcore summertime coon hunter in Florida. I did, however, expect to do a lot more coon hunting in the wintertime than I have in the last few years. Some friends I mentioned earlier, Bill and Pam Slaughter. Bill is a farrier. He has access to a lot of properties in this area and actually some very, very good coon hunting properties. But Bill, like a lot of us, you know, has gotten older and his health is not as good. And he's not physically able to hunt like he used to. And therefore, you know, I'm not hunting with Bill anymore. And the access to those properties is not there anymore, you know. So that's been the big drastic change to me. And that's why I went into partnerships on these dogs so that I could – you know, on occasion go and enjoy the dog and enjoy the hunts at certain times of the year and just face the music that at my age, you know, it's not going to be an every night thing. If I still lived in Michigan and if the same thing you just mentioned wasn't going on up there where subdivisions were coming in to the farms and all that, sure, I'd be hunting. I'd be hunting a lot more. than I am now. But, you know, you just have to face up to the facts, you know. And Florida is growing so very, very fast. And it cracks me up. And if it's offends somebody, well, get over it. You'll either get over it or you'll be offended for a long, long time. You know, they come down here and they want to bring all the things that made them leave where they came from. Then they want to institute those things when they get down here. That has never made a bit of sense to me. You know, there used to be signs on the bumpers when I came down here in the 60s. It said, "We don't care how you do it up north." And, you know, because people come down, they want to change it, you know, the way that they're used to. And my mother used to say, that irks me. I never knew what an irk was, but that irks me right there for sure. But, you know, time marches on. And we talk about this all the time in our sport. You know, how are we going to adapt to the urban sprawl, the influx of a population, the changes in attitudes, the kids that don't grow up on the farm anymore. They grow up, I don't know how they grow up, really. They grow up with a screen 2 inches in front of their nose, and that's all they know. And how do we cope with that? How do we promote? You know, we just do what we can, you know. We do the best we can, and, you know, we've got wildlife management areas here in Florida, keeping with our theme here of hunting the Florida swamps. We do have some wildlife management areas, some public land that we can hunt, and I'll tip my hat to Gary Langford, my friend that lives up at, what is that, Ignis? Is that the name of the town, Gary?
I thought he lived in Dunellen, didn't he?
Well, it's in that area. Yeah, it's north of me here, about an hour roughly. Gary worked extremely hard trying to get coon hunting opened up in a lot of these wildlife management areas because they'll let the boys run their deer dogs in the daytime in these areas, which that's great. I'm all for it, 100%. But then when it comes to nighttime, they want to say, no, no, you know. And then, of course, the deer hunters haven't helped us out. You know, they even the deer doggers, because, you know, we've been to meetings and sat down with these people and said, you know, you've got this privilege of running dogs in the daytime. How about giving us a privilege to run our hounds at night? Oh, I don't know about that. You know, so it's a case of hunters not working with hunters. And that is so foolish, very foolish.
And I know you and everybody else that coon hunts and all have seen it too. And you can't make the deer hunters understand. They think by hearing a hound dog bark, it's going to scare the deer out of the woods. And how many times we walk to a tree or just see them standing out there or whatever and ain't bothering them one bit, you know.
Yeah, well,
you can't convince them of that.
Yeah, you can't teach somebody something they don't want to learn. You know, they don't want to hear that. They would rather believe otherwise. You know, so So there's a big job ahead of us. But those of us that love it are going to try to do it as long as we can. What about? What about the coon population? People think we've got lots and lots of coons down here, and I guess around the dumpsters at McDonald's and so places we do. But what do you think about the population?
It depends on the area that you hunt. Like the area I hunt, the coons are pretty scarce. There'll be a few more come in when the crops are there, but most of the time, if you tree one a night, that's a pretty good night. Like I said, in them groves in the summertime, you may tree one or two around there, but you won't tree most of those until the fruit comes in. I mean, unless you're putting feeder buckets out and you're baiting them or whatever, you know, to draw them in this area, you know, you're going to tree one, maybe two. And I know probably some of that depends on the dog power you're leading too. But, and then there's some places you're fortunate enough to get on these ranches or whatever, you may tree two or three a night. You know, it just, I guess it's like a hunt. It's like the luck of the draw. Where do you, you know, get to go? So, but, and like I said, I know the area I got to hunt, it's not the greatest, but I'm just thankful that I got a place to go, you know, for two or three drops. It's, you know, it's not great, but at least it just, like I said, it still gives me an opportunity to go.
Yeah. Well, I think you have some spots there that at least are safe for your dog. You know, as far as, you know, you don't worry too much about them being on a highway. Yeah. Or treeing in somebody's backyard.
Yes.
You but know, and those
the tracking collars have really helped about the high, especially if they get on the road and want to run it, at least with these trackers now that we got, we can put a stop to that or at least try to run them down to keep them from, you know, which that's right. Really helped out a lot.
Right. Okay, let's talk about dogs just a little bit. And we're going to wind this thing up. Over the years, what are some of the good dogs that you remember you'd like to have on your lead again?
Oh my goodness, I've drawn some good ones.
Maybe
in
yours or somebody else.
It's mostly somebody else's. So, I mean, the ones I got, they're decent, but they're, you know, they're no world beaters. But I lucked out one time. He didn't win the cast that night, but I saw when Dan Canarian owned Apollo before he sold him. I seen him go one night, and I like how he operated. And then years ago when Jarvis Umpers had, it was in Ridgeland, South Carolina, that's when he had the Homer dog, and I drew him, and he looked real mm-hmm. good when I saw him.
Sire and, bone collector.
Yes, sir. And he was, that's like I said, that's when Jarvis owned him at that time. And then there was one that I always, in this area, and what really impressed me, Orlis ended up getting him. He was off a Stylish Hayes.
Orlis Roberts.
Yes, sir.
From over around Polk City.
Haines City. Yes, sir.
Haines
he City. Bought a dog. Right. He bought a dog from some guys in Virginia that was off a Stylish Hayes they called Gabby. And that dog is about one of the most, he always rags about me because he said, boy, you won't forget him, will you? I said, no. He just was one of them. He come from Virginia into Florida. And most dogs you bring into Florida, it takes them about a week or so to adapt to this country. And he just took to it like nothing. And he was one of them dogs for down here that you could go to a major hunt and literally believe that you had a chance to win. He just seemed to make it happen. He was just that type of dog. Mm-hmm. I mean, he big headed, big, tall, blanky walker dog. I don't know what he was on the bottom, but I know his sire was Hayes. And he ended up selling him to Byron Overstreet.
Hard knocking, Stylish Hayes.
Yes, sir. And then he ended up, and I literally tried everything in the world. I didn't know him, but I tried everything in the world to keep him from selling him. But he sold him to Byron Overstreet and Bobby Davenport over there at Scottsmore, and they pushed him pretty good in the hunts, and he won a lot. But he unfortunately ended up getting out there on 95 one night and got killed. He was probably 5 or 6, I think, at that time. Mm-hmm. But he was one of them that whatever I got after that, I compared it to him. He was just that type of dog.
Well, you mentioned Byron Overstreet. And, of course, you and I hunted with Byron, probably one of the last hunts that Byron was able to make.
Yeah, I think it was Hazelhurst, I believe, wasn't it?
Up at Hazelhurst, we went to one of those, what was it, Heritage Hunts? Or
the Legacy hunt they had, yes.
Yeah.
The Three Rivers champ.
Yeah, in Byron's memory, he was a well-known Florida coon hunter from over on the East Coast. He and I stayed back at the trucks that night. You were handling the cruise dog for me. And Oliver Wynn was was hunting a dog that night in the cast, which I think Byron and Oliver hunted together quite a bit, didn't they?
Yes, they were partners on a couple of dogs.
Yeah. And I was just thinking the other day, as the Tournament of Champions final three was being announced and the play-by-plays and all that stuff, Byron would have been real pleased with Oliver's showing.
Oh, yes.
With the Z-Dog. Listeners will remember Z finished second and in a real tight contest there that was won by Dustin Weed. But, you know, just remembering, you know, Byron and I had a good conversation that night at the trucks, and he was so sick. You know, he was taking treatments for cancer, and he'd have to excuse himself and go back behind the truck. He'd get sick, and then he'd come back, and we'd talk. And just wanted to mention him and his memory. I enjoyed hunting with him. I didn't hunt with him a lot. Didn't know all that much about Byron. But I do know he was
definitely
a
good guy. So yeah. He was a tough competitor too. He was out there. He was nice, but he was out there to win too.
Oh, I don't doubt it. Yeah, not at all. And I think that's that's the game. You know, who plays a game they don't want to win, right?
Oh yeah, we got into it one night. It got down to me and him, and I got ahead of him, and he's like, "You better train your dog, because mine goes in there, I'm going to train." I'm like, "I know." And it was down to like the last minute, and he kept saying, "You better train. You better train. I'm going to train. And he's coming there, and he located for like 5 seconds, and he treed him. And we walked around there, and mine backed him. I was like, "Well, if he beats me, he beats me." And thank goodness it was on an empty tree, so it didn't matter. But I said, "I knew what you were trying to do." And the whole way back, he was laughing, just trying to get me to jump the gun. So
yeah, that was humorous about that TOC final. I think Weed was trying to get was telling Oliver, "It's okay if you want to treat your dog."
Oh yeah, we're at the stationary. Oh yeah.
Yeah. Oh, the games people play, right?
Oh yeah, but you know, looking back now, Matt, I mean, it was fun.
Where do you think we'd be able to have this conversation again in 10 years? You think we got 10 more years now? Well, I know I'm going to be older than dirt. I hope I do. But, you know, I think the boys over there around Ocklawaha in that area over there with that club, and we mentioned Malcolm and some of those boys and all that. They're fairly active, and I think Ike Rainey has pumped a lot of life into coon hunting, at least for that group over there. Do you think there's a future here in Florida for a coon hunter?
If the building doesn't get where, I mean, I don't know how much more that, you know, the area can take, but hopefully it'll last, you know, like I said, at least in that area and everything, hopefully it'll last a while. You know, I'm, you know, hoping in my lifetime it never gets where I, you know, can't never do it anymore just because of that. But, you know, I guess, well, I can wait and see.
Yeah. Well, I can imagine here. I live in the town of Port Richey. There's also a new Port Richey that's just south of us. And just south of that is Tarpon Springs and then Clearwater and then St. Pete. Across the bay is Tampa and on we go. All of those areas are expanding. Everything is growing. East of Port Richey, building like you wouldn't believe. Some new tracks, as many as 5,000 new single-family homes. It's amazing, and this was all land that was pasture fields and those beautiful bay heads, as we call them, you know, so it's going to be tough, but hopefully it'll go on. And I imagine that somewhere there's a kid that's just growing up enough to go out there and hear a dog running tree for the first time that'll catch the bug like you have back and carry on the tradition here in Sunshine State. I sure hope so.
Yes, sir. The only thing that hurts around here now is not so much the coon hunters, these young guys. I guess it's more exciting to them. You know, everybody wants to be a hog hunter around here now. So I guess it's the thrill of fighting or catching the hog or something, I guess. But I'm hoping I'll meet somebody someday that'll, you know, maybe get a little interested in it and, you know,
like you said, a good hunting buddy for you.
Hopefully, you know, catch the bug in time or something. Hopefully.
Yeah, so. Exactly. Well, you know, that's happening in other areas with the bear hunters, too. And I had this conversation with someone the other day about how, you know, bear hunting is getting to be very popular in their area, more so than coon hunting. And it's the excitement factor. And it's the fact that there's so many more bear now. You know, I can go out my door here and go over to Highway 19, which runs up and down the coast, west coast of Florida, and I won't go 10 miles till I see a bear crossing sign. And all the way up 19, there are signs, you know, where bear have been spotted crossing the highway. Bear are everywhere. Of course, we don't have a season in Florida. And there again, you know, these people that move here from other places and, you know, they're educated way beyond their intelligence. And, you know, and they come up with these rules and regulations and they get placed on the Wildlife Commission and they make decisions that affect us. And there's no common sense involved, you know. Hey, I'm at the age where I believe in let's call a spade a spade. I don't believe in putting anybody down maliciously or personal insult, but some of these people don't, as they'd say back home, they don't have walking around sense when it comes to knowing how to manage our wildlife and to take care of it. And, you know, Teddy Roosevelt's my hero, greatest president we ever had. I believe because of the stand that he took for wildlife and, you know, and the great American model of wildlife management. And we wouldn't have these species now if those actions hadn't been taken back then. But, you know, instead, we're introducing wolves in areas where they'll decimate the deer and the elk and everything else, you know, because, hey, you know, who doesn't think a wolf's cool, you know? One of the funniest things I've seen in a while on social media the other day was a reel where somebody out in Yellowstone, some people gather around watching this buffalo, and a buffalo decided to pick out this woman over there in a white shirt. Man, I mean, He could have flipped her from the 50-yard line right straight through the goalposts. Man, he flipped that woman a long way. Mm. And I thought, that's funny. That's cool. Yeah.
Well, there was a thing on TV the other day. I don't know exactly where, but they were showing it. These couple little bear cubs, and instead of leaving them alone, the ladies go over there and starts reaching and grabbing for them right there in the tree and everything. And it didn't take long. Here come mama. And I'm like, you know, that's why you don't touch them things. It, you know, Mother Nature will take care of herself, but they don't seem to see it that way.
Mama ain't got time for that.
No.
Well, it's a different world we live in, Mac.
Yes,
but listen,
sir.
It's been great to visit with you, and I appreciate your time today. And
yes,
we need
sir,
to get
no
together
problem.
And go hunt before that thermometer rises too many more clicks.
Yes,
it's
for
getting
April,
on toward
this isn't
the time.
Bad weather now, for us now anyway.
We've had some pretty decent days here. Well, our winter was kind of crazy. It was not it was kind of cool. We didn't get any real cold, hard frosts or anything, but we got a lot of cold, damp, cloudy days. You know, the Chamber of Commerce did not make a lot of money on this winter, I don't think. But we know that summer's coming.
Yes.
And down here, the people up north endure the winter after Christmas, you know, hard freeze sets in and and things get tough. Well, things are starting to get tough for us down here.
Yeah,
it's a different world.
Yes.
It's a different world. Do you have any observation about what would be the main difference between hunting coons in Florida and up in the Midwest where most people hunt?
I just say the ground and all, I think here, well, naturally up in Ohio and Illinois, Michigan, all your coon are a lot more plentiful. But I think a lot of it has to do with the terrain, because up there, I think that clay and everything, I think it holds that scent a little bit better, like I said, than it does down here. You're getting this sand or whatever, and I just don't think it holds the scent as good. It makes it tough on a dog. You know, you get a little bit of rain and some moisture on the ground, it makes it better. But I think that's the biggest mm-hmm. difference down here is, you know, being able to the tracking ability and everything. And most of the woods up there, you know, like where they was doing the TOC, what I could see, I mean, it was a little hilly, but it wasn't really a lot of thick and underbrush. Where down here, they got to, you know, weave and climb and, you know, a lot of, you know, different things down here, obstacles, I guess you got to say, they got to deal with a little bit. So,
well, I think you make a great point there that a lot of people may not think about. You know, we think about out west, the dry ground lion hunters that trail in that old, you know, desert sand and rock and all of that. And it takes a real cold trailer, a meticulous cold trailer. I mean, that really grinds that track out. Well, you know, you get that kind of situation here too. And, you know, with all the vegetation, that does not enhance a dog's ability to track either. I remember in the summers in West Virginia, training bear dogs in August, the dogs would have very hard time cold trailing and all that thick stuff, all that weeds, all that pollen, all that, you know, when the frost would come and lay that stuff down, you know, it seemed like, boy, they just caught another gear. They could just trail so much better, you know. So that aspect of Florida hunting, I think we overlook sometimes.
Well, it's like, too, and I know it doesn't seem easy to believe, but like in those orange groves, when the blooms would come out, and I'm sure you've been in there years ago when you could smell them and how strong those blooms can get, and that, I think, affects the dog somehow with their nose and everything, because you're trying to smell a track, and you get such that strong smell, mm-hmm. you know, I think that affects them somewhat.
Well,
we noticed when the blooms were in, they didn't seem to operate as good as when they weren't in.
Yeah,
and maybe that was, and maybe that was the dogs too. I don't know. So,
well, no matter what we're leading, we always wish we had a better one, don't we?
Yes. And then when it's gone, it's like it wasn't as bad as what I thought it was.
Yeah, we had old Cruz. We thought we had us a good one going there for a while, but yes, I don't know if it was that, if that was the thyroid issue that he had was all the problem or not, but the fellow that's got him now loves him.
Well, and I mean, really, as long as he's offering, maybe that was it. So I never have really understood the thyroid stuff, but I guess it's something new, and I guess it affects a lot of dogs.
Well, it does, and there's a lot of proof that the guys that keep their dogs on medication and do it right, you know, they do improve. So I guess the thyroid regulates a lot of things, and one of them is the nose or the ability to smell. So,
yes, sir.
Well, Mac, Britt, I think we're going to wind this thing up, you know, and hopefully we can get together soon before the weather gets too hot. We get out with the hounds again. It's been a privilege to talk to you, my friend. I always enjoy it. Well,
thank you for asking me.
Oh, we always have a good time when we go hunting, and I want to do that as many times as we can. Coming up, folks, that's going to do it for the Gone to the Dogs podcast for this week. We are doing the Wheel of Names spin on Facebook on my page, Stephen F. Fielder. We post a question of the week each week, and it's based on the current podcast. You listen to the podcast, you correctly answer the question, you private message it to me. And if you got it right, we'll put your name on the wheel and we'll spin it on Friday evenings at 5:30 Eastern time. And the prizes are a $30 Zepp Lifetime Coon Squaller, three reeds, metal design with a nice paracord lanyard on it, made by Mark Zepp. Everybody knows Big Mark. Also, an autographed or signed copy, a first edition issue of Gone to the Dogs, A Coon Hunter's Journey, the book that I wrote about my escapades around the country over the years. And also, there's some decals and things of that nature for you. So if you want to participate, just go and check me out. Send me a friend request, and I'll approve you. And we'll see you on the spin at Friday on Fridays at 5:30 on Facebook. Don't have anything. I will be traveling up to West Virginia this week, and I'll tell you about it next week when I get back home. I'm going to try to do some recording when I'm there. I'm going to record with Troy Smith, who was named the Outstanding Youth Member of the Trainwalker Breeders and Fanciers Association just at this recent Walker Days up in Indiana. So I'm looking forward to that and sharing that with you. And that's going to do it for this week, folks. If anybody asks you, where is Steve Fielder? Say, well, the weather's getting warmer, so he's probably sitting in the air with a big iced tea, dreaming about the days when he was gone to the dogs. Good night, folks.